from Paris to Portland. You've picked up the guidebooks. You've followed the advice. This is the Fromer Travel Show. Pauline Fromer, president of Fromer Media, and Jason Cochran, editor-in-chief of Fromers.com, with the most complete, the most up-to-date travel information available anywhere. The pages of the Fromer's guidebooks come alive right now, exclusively on 77 WABC.
And welcome to the Fromer Travel Show. Happy Saturday, October 20th. I'm Jason Cochran. Pauline Fromer has the day off, and we have a replacement, but he's not just any replacement. We have the travel writer of the year, travel journalist of the year, from the Society of American Travel Writers. His name is Chris Reynolds from the LA Times. Hi, Chris.
Hey, Jason. Nice to be here.
Welcome to the travel show. Thanks for coming in.
I appreciate it.
Chris is going to be with us all hour long. Now, I'm telling you, he is travel journalist of the year. He's been around the world and written all about it. He's based in California, and so he can answer pretty much any major California question that you have, as well as probably anything around the world. The guy is one of the best experts in travel. So I'm going to give you that number now, but we're going to kick it off with a couple of thoughts about what you might want to call in about. The number is 800-848-9222. We thought we would pose as the question of the day, what do you think would be a great bucket trip destination in California? And Chris has his own thoughts about this, given that California is one of the greatest American destinations for attractions. What are a couple that come to mind, Chris, that anyone should not miss, even if they don't live in California?
Well, thank you for that one. That's Jason's being my shill on that question, because I've spent a large chunk of the last 2 years working on a project called the California Bucket List. And I should say I was born and raised in California. I've never spent a winter in snow. Sorry about that. I've seen snow, but I've never spent a full season in it. Anyway, so as a lifelong Californian, I decided it's time to go out and actually hit all those places you hear about. I've got a colleague named David Kiffin who likes to say, Los Angeles is like your brain. You only use 10% of it, but what if you used more? I feel that way about California. And so I set out to come up with a long bucket list. And of course, I'm still working on it because you don't want to complete a bucket list, right? Because I don't want to think about what happens after that.
Bucket, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And the thing that you end up settling on when you try to figure out where to start with California, there was a travel writer about 100 years ago who wrote one of the first travel books about California. And, you know, he assumed that a traveler would have months and months to spend on a trip. But his conclusion was the first thing you need to do is go to Yosemite and stay for a full week. And you know, that's still not bad advice. Yeah,
interestingly, that hasn't changed. Even though we only have 2 weeks vacation, many of us, a week in Yosemite is still a pretty good prescription.
Yeah, absolutely. And by Yosemite, most travelers immediately think of Yosemite Valley, which is where you stand at the foot of the 2,000 or 2,500 foot granite cliffs and look up and see Half Dome and see the waterfalls. The first waterfall you usually see is Yosemite Falls, which is like 2,400 feet. It's one of the largest waterfalls in the world. There's a little wind blowing. Interesting things happen with the water. There's a trail that goes up next to it. I think a lot of people think about the coastline when they think of California, but standing in Yosemite Valley at the foot of Yosemite Falls is a pretty transcendent California kind of moment.
So the callers might have their own thoughts about some of the most transcendent moments that they've had when they went to California or the American West. The number is 800-848-9222. Now, you don't have to talk about California. You have a California expert here to take advantage of for free. But if you want to ask about something else, if you're taking a vacation anywhere else in the world and we can maybe help you make your plans, go ahead and give us a call about that too, because we're here for you for the next hour. So it's interesting, Chris, that the Yosemite Falls being maybe one of the tallest waterfalls in the world, like you said, if the park weren't there, it weren't called Yosemite, it would be the attraction. We would know about that waterfall, you know, without the park around it. We would just say, oh, it's going to go see that waterfall out in California.
Yeah, absolutely. But because there are a couple other waterfalls in the valley, and because there's Half Dome, and because the tall sequoia trees are nearby, it's an ensemble show, the Yosemite National Park experience. But there is something riveting in a natural way about a waterfall, right? People will gather and people will just feel better standing in its presence.
Now, I've hiked to the top of Yosemite Falls, and it took me much longer than I wanted it to because I am getting up there in years. But it was one of the highlight days I've ever spent at a national park as I walked that zigzag path all the way to the top. And the view at the top made me never want to come down again.
Oh, yeah, it's tremendous. That trail, I think, has some things in common with the Grand Canyon in that people who may not have a lot of business out there on a great big hike suddenly get there and decide that they're ready to take on the whole thing. So there can be an element of danger if you undertake that hike and you haven't prepared.
There was a rattlesnake curled up sleeping next to the path. I mean, this is something that you'll see all the time, and you don't panic because it's asleep and it's not ready to attack, and you just know how to deal with the wildlife. You don't step on it, please. But it was something that if you're not used to seeing that kind of thing, or if you're a panicker, not the greatest idea. It could be the true bucket list item if you're not careful.
Yeah. You want to keep that bucket list concept abstract, yeah. If you can.
We do have a call from someone, John from the Jersey Shore. Hey, John, you are on the Frommer Travel Show. How can we help you? John?
Not by shore, though. I'm on a different shore, okay? But I was out in California about 20 years ago. One of the most transcendent moments was when I walked into Muir Woods. It was about 90 degrees in San Francisco. When I got into Muir Woods, it must have been 75, I'd say. And that was just mesmerizing for me. I happen to like plants and trees, and it was incredible.
It really is one of the most beautiful groves of trees in the world. It's interesting because John Muir was known for hanging out in Yosemite for quite a while, but now his woods north of San Francisco are one of the most popular attractions in the entire state. Wouldn't you agree, Chris?
I would. In fact, I'm going to be lecturing on a California cruise in a few weeks, and the first place we're going when we get off the ship in San Francisco is getting on a minibus and heading straight up to Muir Woods.
And everyone does that. It's a pretty crowded place these days.
Yeah, actually, it's become a challenge for the National Park Service, and so it's nice that we're going to be arriving in minibuses, because if you show up in a car, well, you have to make an advance reservation now. They've just put that in place in the last year or 18 months.
John, did you have to make a reservation when you went there?
Oh, no, not at that time. It wasn't that traveled. It was beautiful, and San Francisco is one of the most amazing cities I've been into, so it was a wonderful trip.
And you can combine Muir Woods not just with San Francisco, but with the wine country, and I hope you did that when you were there.
We did that, absolutely. We did that, no doubt about it. That's what we did. This next summer, we're planning on taking a motorhome out west and going to Yosemite. I've never been there, so thanks for that advice.
That's a terrific idea. Just my advice for that, and I'm sure Chris will agree, is make your reservations as far ahead as you can, because getting in a motorhome and going to campsites is one of the most popular things to do in California, and so that stuff books up early.
Absolutely. And another thing to know, if you haven't been to Yosemite, is that the entrance to the park is about 45 minutes from Yosemite Valley. So just when you cross the ranger station or on the way into the park, you've still got a little bit of driving to do, and those are two-lane country roads.
So try it during the daylight. John, thank you so much for giving us a call. We appreciate that call. If you have a call about California or anywhere else on the planet that you'd like to go and want to know about, the number is 800-848-9222. Do you have another idea for a California bucket list item, Chris?
Well, I'll stay with waterfalls for just one moment. Good. To say the other waterfall that people I think close their eyes and see when they imagine California is the waterfall in Big Sur. You know the one I mean, that cascades down from the rocks and lands on the beach. It's gorgeous. It's called McWay Falls, although most people from outside California don't know that. And it sort of represents for me the impossible California dream, because it's great and you can just imagine standing underneath it and letting the water fall on your head, but you can't get to that beach. There are too many rocks and too much rough surf to come in by boat in a safe way, and there's no trail down there. There is a great flat, easy trail that goes from the PCH to a Pacific Coast Highway that takes you, I don't know, it's maybe a mile, maybe less than a mile, that takes you to a spot where you can look down on the falls and the surrounding view, but it's a waterfall you have to admire from a distance.
It sounds like a recipe to get tourists in trouble if they can't get there safely and they try.
I have seen international tourists bushwhacking in places where they should not be bushwhacking, like at the top of 100-foot drops.
Yeah, and this area of the California coastline, it does sometimes have landslips.
Yeah, and in fact, that's a thing to bear in mind about the Big Sur area, because for more than a year, the Pacific Coast Highway was closed south of Big Sur because of a great big landslide.
This was just recently.
Yes, and they've cleaned it up. They've cleared it off, tons and tons of dirt to be moved. And in, I believe it was July, they reopened. And the good news is that means all those businesses around Big Sur, which are really dependent on the Pacific Coast Highway for business, can go back to business as usual. There's a fancy resort there called the Post Ranch Inn, and they were getting all their customers by helicopter for a while.
Well, that must be very expensive.
Oh, yeah.
But that's not their normal practice, I imagine.
No, I think it is their occasional practice, even when the road is open. But anyway, the road is open now, and there are lots of great things to see there. And now that we're heading into fall, there's going to be a little bit less traffic on that road, and it's a better time to visit.
Well, that's good to know and good to plan for. And if you have travel that you want to plan for, please do give us a call, 800-848-9222. We're also on Twitter, at Frommers, F-R-O-M-M-E-R-S, Facebook, the same name. And if you're shy and you'd rather not be on the radio, I don't know why, we're nice people. The email is frommertravelshow@yahoo.com. But I just wanted to make a little subject change. We were talking about landslides, changing people's vacations, having to make other plans. Sometimes that happens in travel. Sometimes things make you have to cancel your plans, or things go wrong, or you feel ill and need to get home. And for reasons like that, for times like that, you need to get travel insurance. And we are so happy that our partner for this show is Allianz Travel Insurance. They make this show possible. They help you because they help us. And if you get travel insurance through Allianz, you'll make sure that if something terrible happens to your plans, you will be eligible to get your money back or have another plan put in place by them. If you want to get more information about that, you'll go to Allianz Travel. That's A-L-L-I-A-N-Z, travelinsurance.com. One more time, A-L-L-I-A-N-Z, travelinsurance.com.
Get a jump on vacation plans. The Frommer Travel Show. Pauline Frommer and Jason Cochran. 77 WABC.
Today's program is brought to you by Allianz. Protect your travel investments with Allianz. Visit A-L-L-I-A-N-Z, travelinsurance.com. And we're back and we're taking calls, your calls. So give us a call, 800-848-9222. We're right here answering questions for the rest of the hour. I'm here with Chris Reynolds, Travel Journalist of the Year. He's a staff travel writer at the Los Angeles Times. He's a huge California expert, but of course, he's seen the world. And he is here at your disposal, as am I. Give us a ring, 800-848-9222. During the break, Chris and I were talking a little bit about San Francisco's version of Ellis Island. It's a place called Angel Island, and it fills a similar role. Can you talk a little bit about Angel Island and if you can go see it today?
I would love to. This is one of those places in California that I never got to until I made it my mission to see every place important. And it's a place that I'm in my 50s. When I was growing up, it wasn't a place that I heard about in my school history classes, even in California history classes. But it basically served as a West Coast Ellis Island from about 1900 to 1940.
So roughly the same period, too.
Yeah, exactly. But of course, it was more focused on Asian immigrants, and quite unlike Ellis Island. I think in Ellis Island, the average European incoming immigrant passed through there in a matter of hours. And in Angel Island, it was very different because at that time we had laws in effect to reduce the amount of immigration by Chinese laborers in particular. Mm-hmm. Once the Chinese laborers had played a key role on building the railroads out to the west, people got nervous about too many jobs ending up in the hands of immigrants. And so as a result, they made it difficult for Chinese people to come into the country. It was an exclusion law passed in 1882. So if you were a Chinese immigrant or from another part of Asia and you came into Angel Island, you might spend days or weeks or months there. And over that time, there were barracks there, and the immigrants started writing poems on the walls, like
are
marking
still
poems
there?
On
you
the walls.
See them as a visitor?
They are. Nobody noticed it for decades until they were getting ready to, I don't know, knock down the barracks or do something with them. And somebody looked closely and said, "My goodness, look at
That's
what
incredible.
We have on the walls."
Is this run by the National Park Service?
No, I have to confess, I wish it were, because they would have a little bit more money. It's run by California State
Park
System,
which has some incredible properties, but yes, not the money.
Yeah, you know, it's a funny thing. People think Big Sur must be a national park. It's not. It's California state parks. People think Hearst Castle might be a national park. No, it's a California state park. And the same is true for Angel Island. Angel Island, unfortunately, doesn't have the profile of these other places. It's a very attractive island. You can go out there and ride a bike around the road there. You take a ferry to get there. It's not very far from Alcatraz, which is one of the most popular tourist attractions in the entire state. And by the way, that's a place I always thought was probably kind of cheesy. But once I got there, I thought that was a brilliant place to visit as well.
It's very creepy, in fact.
Yeah.
And there's more history there than just, of course, the prisoners as well. There's this whole Native American movement that has a whole story there as well. But I want to give the number out to everybody because we're talking about California right now, but we can talk about anything. Give us a call. We'll help you with your vacation plans, your vacation ideas. If you want to know where to go next year, or just give us some criteria. We'll try to figure it out with you. The number is 800-848-9222. But of course, Chris is a California expert, and he has a lot more to say about it.
Well, nobody's ever going to be a full expert on California because it's just so inexhaustible. But I would say that once you start thinking about getting on the water in the San Francisco Bay Area, there are a lot of possibilities. There's Alcatraz, there's Angel Island, which is great, you know, a great natural setting in addition to having that underappreciated history. You can take a ferry. Well, there's the ferry building, which has become this great sort of foodie mall and gathering place on the Embarcadero.
And that's that thing at the end of Market Street. You see in pictures of San Francisco going back 100 years with the giant tower kind of centered right in the middle of that long Market Street.
Yeah, I think that building is probably one of the biggest, apart from the Golden Gate Bridge, perhaps the biggest landmark in San Francisco. And interestingly, you know, before the Golden Gate Bridge was built in, I think, 1937, before that, ferries were crucial to the way San Francisco worked economically, and thousands of people commuted by ferry, and that ferry building was the point at which people came in and went out of the city. So it's fascinating to get in there, get some good food, because there's a lot of good fancy food, and think about the history of that place, and then you can walk up the Embarcadero, and there's plenty in San Francisco to keep you busy there. There's the Exploratorium, which is great for kids.
Is San Francisco affordable? Every time I'm going there, there's some sort of convention happening, or all that digital money is keeping the room rates really high.
Yeah, I would love to tell you that you're wrong about that, but I cannot. It's expensive. Yeah. You just have to
Airbnb, perhaps, or
Airbnb,
like it.
Or think about Oakland across the bay as a place to stay and make trips into the city. But yeah, it's going to be expensive. There's a place in San Francisco I will mention. At the edge of North Beach, called the San Remo Inn. I think it was built either just before or just after the earthquake, so it's more than 100
years
old.
I know, it stayed here, yeah. Mm-hmm. And we say North Beach, just for people who don't know, it's like an Italian-American neighborhood. It's where Marilyn Monroe got married to, who's the guy?
Joe DiMaggio.
Thank you. On the steps of the church there's a famous picture of them. But so it's a great, great sort of authentic feeling neighborhood just north of the financial district in San Francisco. But the San Remo Inn.
Yeah, you can actually, I haven't checked the rates in the last week or two, but they're cheap rooms which have, you know, share bathrooms down the hall. It's very much a European hostel type situation, but you can get in there for $100 or less than $100.
Well, that's not too bad.
No, it's and it's at the edge of North Beach, so there's, and you can also walk to Fisherman's Wharf from there.
Yeah, and Coit Tower is not too far away from there.
Yeah, it actually, Coit Tower is something I like to point people towards, because people think, what's the big deal? It's a tower. It's like 200 feet high. It kind of looks like a fire hose nozzle, and you get a nice view of the city. But for me, the point of Coit Tower is not the tower part. It's all the murals at the base of the tower, because they did a WPA project during the Depression in the 1930s, and someone got the idea to paint murals at the base of Coit Tower, and they're amazing murals done by, I don't know, more than a dozen different artists. You can spend a lot of time at Coit Tower just looking at all those murals and get a real time capsule of San Francisco in the 1930s.
Yeah, and it's good for your calves as well, as I remember. Because it's not just the tower, which there is an elevator in the middle, but you have to get up to the hill that has the tower.
That's right, yeah.
San Francisco is not a place for those weak of calf, I'll tell you that.
Yeah.
Well, the number, everybody, is 800-848-9222. Please don't let this week happen what happens every other week, which is we get a ton of calls at the end, at the last 10 minutes, and we have to race through them and everyone doesn't get their questions answered. So please give us a call now, 800-848-9222, and we'll answer your travel questions. But for now, until we get that call, we're still talking about California, and we've happened to be in San Francisco for the last little bit. But I also want to talk about another place that we had mentioned during the break. It's a place that not a lot of Americans know is available to tour, partly because it's in kind of the, you know, this very desolate, empty area east of the Sierra Nevada mountain range. And that's a place called Manzanar. Will you explain to everyone what Manzanar is and what the experience is like when you go?
Sure. And once again, this is a place that I did not hear much about when I was going to California public schools when I was younger. But it, I can tell you, since my daughter has now gone through California public schools, or is going through them, that that they hear about it now. Manzanar was one of the camps, internment camps, that Japanese Americans were sent to once World War II started. Thousands of families passed through Manzanar. And
but they say pass through. They just stay there until the war was done.
Yeah, in some cases, 3 years, yeah. 4 years, 3 years anyway. It's at the foot of the Sierra, and it's in an area called Owens Valley. Mm-hmm. A pretty stark landscape, as you say. It's a fascinating drive to go up the Highway 395 through the Owens Valley. It takes you through Bishop and Lone Pine and places where lots of old Western movies were
all
filmed.
All the old Westerns. In fact, sometimes Tarantino still films up there, but all the old Westerns that you know, Bad Day at Black Rock and all those were all shot there.
Oh, yeah, the Lone Ranger rearing back on his horse. Mm-hmm. I think that's in the Alabama Hills.
But this camp was basically, you know, where they were, people were rounded up, kept, and you can still tour it now, but a lot of the houses that they lived in were taken away after the war, leaving this very windswept, dusty bones of this old place where they had to live.
Exactly, and they've reconstructed a lot of it, so you can get a sense. There's kind of a galley, so you can see the kitchen setup, and it makes you think of things you never thought about. Like, for instance, once they were interned in the camp, and they set people up with the job of cooking for everybody, there was a dispute between the Americanized Japanese who wanted American food and the less Americanized Japanese who wanted Japanese food in their internment camp. And it became, you know, I guess a little bit of a political discussion. I wish I could tell you how it got sorted out. But I do know, obviously, World War II ended. The camp emptied. I think a lot of people didn't want to think about it again. Now the National Park Service runs the location. Mm-hmm.
And there aren't many of these locations left. Most of them have been developed. And so this is maybe one of the only couple that you can actually tour still.
Yeah, yeah.
Across the country. They were nationwide, especially in the Midwest and the West at the time.
Right. And it's one thing to kind of appreciate that history in the abstract. But as it happened, at my office, the guy who leads the tour guides, Daryl Kunitomi, has family members who were interned there. And when you talk to somebody whose own family's personal history was shaped or derailed by having been sent to that camp, it changes your understanding of a place a little bit. And that's a valuable thing for anyone, whether you're from inside California or outside California, to think about some of the hardships that happened on the way to getting where we are.
Yeah, yeah, it's something really to think about. Most national parks, it's just something from the history books. This is something that you can actually meet someone who lived there. Tom, we've got you waiting in the call queue. We're going to get right to you as soon as we get back from this break. But in the meantime, we'll see you in just a couple minutes after these messages.
The most popular destinations for you and your family right here. Pauline Frommer and Jason Cochran, The Frommer Travel Show, 77 WABC.
And welcome back to The Frommer Travel Show. We have a half an hour left, so there's a realm of questions that we can answer if you call 800-848-9222. We have sitting here with me today, Travel Journalist of the Year and massive California expert, Chris Reynolds from the Los Angeles Times. So take advantage of it. But first, we're going to go to the phones. We have Tom from Mendham, New Jersey, giving us a call. Hi, Tom. You're live on the air. How can we help you?
Hi, gentlemen. Sorry the question is not about California.
That's good.
Although I love the state.
That's all right.
The only place I'm interested in traveling at this point in my life is Pitcairn Island. So I called about Pitcairn Island, and I'm guessing that you're familiar with the history. It has to do with the Bounty and Captain Bligh, who I guess his crew mutinied, threw him off the ship with a few loyal sailors. Bligh made a famous navigation all the way back home on a rowboat with 12 other guys. Meanwhile, the crew that had mutinied and taken over the actual ship ended up out of supplies and basically running aground on a desolate island, Pitcairn Island.
They way out there in the South Pacific.
You know more
way
than
out
I
there.
Think about some of the details, but I'm somewhat familiar with the history. And I think a whaler taking on water saw either some of the last few survivors, or maybe about 12 years later, and then after that there wasn't any contact for quite a few years. And I think the English UK made it like a kind of a protected area for a while until the descendants of the mutineers died off. And that's all I know about it. But you know what? The Bounty itself, the ship, can be seen, I understand, from an aerial view still in that little
Something else. I didn't know that. That's
isn't
really cool.
That,
for the very few people who are able to go to Pitcairn Island, because, as you said, it's very, very remote. Chris, how do you get to Pitcairn Island if you really wanted to go?
First, save up a bunch of vacation days.
Yeah, and a lot of money, I imagine.
Yeah, I would think so. It's the way to do it, I think, is to fly to Tahiti, and then once a week, Air Tahiti does a flight that gets you to Pitcairn by way of Mangareva. And please don't ask me any questions about Mangareva, because I'm not really sure about that. But, Pitcairn, it is a remote place, but it's one of those places that looms large in our history. And I think if I go, I want Tom as my guide.
Yeah, right. It seems like you know a lot about it already. I know that you can whale watch still. They do quad bike tours. And as you say, you can see the wrecks of the Bounty and another ship called the Cornwallis, from what I understand.
Yeah, and there are more and more cruise companies going there now. I think the whole South Pacific region is getting more heavily trafficked by cruise ships, and just their traffic goes up every year at Pitcairn. In many cases, you'll only stop there for a few hours, which might be a special kind of torture if you're crazy about the history.
Yeah.
But the diversity of cruise ships that are going in there means that it may become a little bit more affordable.
And if you're really crazy about Captain Bligh in particular, you can stay in his house in London where he went after all that went down. He made it back home even though he was thrown off the ship. It's called the Captain Bligh House. It's in Lambeth. It's almost across the street from the Imperial War Museum in London. And I think he's buried in a church in Lambeth that has now been converted, deconsecrated, and made into the Garden Museum. So there's still some Captain Bligh around as well. You can see a ship and you can see where he eventually dropped anchor.
I think there must be a museum in London to accommodate everything that's ever happened in the world.
If there's a garden museum, for sure.
Yeah, yeah.
Tom, I hope that helps. Yeah, it's as much as we can do, because neither of us have been. All right, Larry from Queens. Larry, we'd love to have you on the travel show next. So you are live. How you doing? Hey, Larry, you're live. How you doing? Okay, we don't hear Larry. Larry, maybe you'll come back to us. So instead, we'll move to Leslie on Staten Island. Hi, Leslie. You're going to be live on the air on the travel show. Leslie, how you doing?
Yes, good. I just want to tell you, my daughter had a wonderful experience in Italy, and I heard your show, and I got her the book on Florence, Rome, and Venice.
Uh-huh.
2018, and she said that made all the difference. She stayed, I guess, at bed and breakfast, whatever, other places where there were some young people. She's 25, and she visited a lot of places, and it was just fantastic. And
I am so happy that you called us to tell that. You know, we don't always hear back from the people after they buy our book, and they talk about the trips, but we don't hear how the books worked for them. So it's always really gratifying for us to hear that they were successful. Tell me, she was a single girl traveling alone. Is that right?
Yes. I was a little concerned about her. Unfortunately, she had an unfortunate marriage, was divorced the year before. We were concerned she'd be traveling mostly by herself.
And there was no concern, right? She did just fine.
She met some people, left her travel bags there, borrowed a backpack, and she was off.
Great.
She had a great time. No problem.
It's a great lesson. Don't let fear stand in your way. You can have a great trip. But thank you so much for letting us know that our guidebooks worked for you. It means a lot to us because we worked so hard on putting them out.
And it's also encouraging to hear, because people who have been to Europe multiple times begin to complain about crowds making some places unvisitable.
Mm-hmm.
And I think sometimes there's a little bit of snobbery in that, because the truth is to be in Florence on a crowded day is still better than not going to Florence.
And it's part of the Florence experience. Imagine an empty Florence. It would not be the same.
Yeah, that's true. Now, having said that, you know, if you can get to Florence in October rather than August, that's a win.
That's good advice. Everybody get on the plane tomorrow. Look, thank you so much for giving us a call, Leslie. We appreciate it. Joanne, Larry, we're going to get to you after the break. For anyone else who wants to call, let me get your fingers ready right now. 800-848-9222, and we can take you after the break. I wanted to let you know a little bit about a new program we've got going on with our sponsor, Allianz Travel Insurance. Now, there is a way for you to, when you buy a policy through Allianz, you get our Frommer's info, the kind that Joanne was talking about, and her daughter who went to Rome, Florence, and Venice. With about a dozen itineraries, you can get information provided by Frommer's when you buy an Allianz travel insurance policy. It's something we're only doing with them, and it's an added perk you get for free just for buying your insurance through Allianz. So if you're interested in that, or just to make sure that your travel investment is protected and your health is going to be safeguarded while you're on the road, then go ahead and go to Allianz Travel Insurance. That's A-L-L-I-A-N-Z, travelinsurance.com.
This is the Frommer Travel Show. Inspiring locations, inspiring ideas for New York. Live, local, on it. 77 WABC.
Today's program is brought to you by Allianz. Protect your travel investments with Allianz. Visit A-L-L-I-A-N-Z, travelinsurance.com. And we want you to get to the phones because we still have a little bit more time to answer all of your travel questions, California or beyond. The number for that is 800-848-9222, which is the number that Larry called. We missed you before, Larry, but we've got you back on the line. What was your question? You're on the air.
Well, I have nothing about California.
That's
however,
okay.
I am going to be visiting the northeast corner of Florida in within the next month. And I'd like to go for a week, and I plan to stay 3 to 4 days in St. Augustine.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's going to leave me 3 to 4 days to do something else. I mean, there's Jacksonville there. There's Amelia Island. I'm pretty far away. I mean, is there anything,
Well, Jacksonville is a great choice. It's an overlooked city. It's really been coming into its own in the last few years. It's been attracting a lot of artists. So there's a lot more artist markets and event days happening all throughout the city, breweries and coffee bars. It's surprising how Jacksonville has come up. But what I've always wanted to do in Northeast Florida that I've never done is the thing that brought Florida on the tourist map to begin with, which is a boat tour down the St. Johns River, which is the river that kind of flows through that part of Florida. I think it might flow northward, which is unusual for a river. But back in the late 1800s, that's how people first discovered the state. They would get on steamships and take long, slow trips through the mangroves and the wildlife. And you can still do it. Maybe not a steamship anymore, but there's many scenic boat tours on the St. Johns River. It's historic. It's incredibly natural. You see a part of Florida that's not just resort beaches or theme parks. So I would have a look at the different St. Johns River scenic tours. And also remember, you're very close to Savannah. You're maybe about 2 hours away if you just drive up the coast. So that would also be worth a look if you've never been to Savannah.
Because great old architecture in Savannah.
One of the most charming cities in the United States. So I hope that helps, Larry.
It helps a lot. Definitely.
Yeah, St. John's River. Let us know how the trip was when you get back. We can't wait to hear about it. Joanne from Verona, New Jersey, you are going to be live in the air now. We'd love to give you a hand, Joanne. Are you there? Joanne?
Yes. Hi.
Hi, Joanne. Hit us. We're live on the air.
Excellent. It is a California question.
Okay.
November 5th to the 10th, I'm going to Palm Springs with my mother. She's an active senior citizen, and we're doing, want to do sightseeing. And I was looking at the map and seeing how close it was to San Diego.
Mm-hmm.
So I was asking your opinion on, number one, in Palm Springs, would you stay inside Palm Springs or can I stay in those neighborhoods around it? And do you think it's doable to drive to San Diego? And if I did drive to San Diego, where would I stay because I have a car then?
Okay. Well, first of all, congratulations on choosing Palm Springs in November because that is a great time of year to be there. I was there this last summer. I looked at my phone and it said 113 degrees. I don't think you want that. You can stay right in downtown Palm Springs. There's actually a hotel called the Kimpton Rowan Hotel that opened.
Yeah, it's still brand new.
Yeah, it's like within the last year it's opened, and it's been part of a big redevelopment project at the heart of downtown. So I would look at that. There are a lot of great places there, and also a lot of Airbnb places out of like modernist houses all around town.
Yeah, because Palm Springs is famous for its mid-century architecture. So if you really want to stay in this really great, sleek, you know, minimalist house, that's the place to do it.
Yeah, there's a former Frank Sinatra house that they rent out. There's the whole place feels like a Rat Pack thing. And I will say, for other folks who are thinking about Palm Springs, and who are interested in modernist design, every year in early in the year, I think this coming year it's in February, they do Modernism Week, in which people who are lovers of that kind of architecture show up from all over the place and really celebrate it. The other thing I would say is, unless you're ready, don't go to Palm Springs between April 12th and April 21st next year, because that's when the Coachella Festival is.
Coachella is a mass, fills with people who go into the concerts. Yeah,
prices go way up, streets clog, and if you're not there for that, it'll be a difficult
time. How about
time.
San Diego, though? It's doable easily, right?
It is. I mean, you'll be on the road for a few hours, but San Diego is great, and it's counterpoint to Palm Springs. I actually grew up in San Diego. It used to be that most of the hotels were in Mission Valley and you stayed there, but San Diego's downtown over the last few decades has really gained a lot of momentum. And if you stay downtown, you can park the car and then leave it in the garage for a few days. There's a lot in downtown. It'll be the wrong time of year for baseball season, but there's a lot going on there. And the downtown is right next to the waterfront. They've got some historic ships. Coronado is there, the Hotel del Coronado, that great historic hotel that goes back to the 1880s. And if you go a little bit farther north along the coast in San Diego, which you'll be able to do because you have a car, there's La Jolla, which is a community of the city of San Diego, but it's really nice. Kind of sandstone cliffs. The University of California at San Diego is there, kind of at the top of the cliffs. In fact, one of my favorite places in all of California is the glider port next to the UC San Diego campus. I don't know if you've ever seen pictures of the Salk Institute. It's this really severe piece of, I think they call it brutalist architecture, but it's right on top of a cliff overlooking the ocean. You can kind of look at the Salk Institute and then walk down to where the hang gliders take off above the cliffs. And there's a little place where you can get a, you know, get a snack, like a sandwich, and watch these men and women run and jump off a cliff. And way down below is Black's Beach, which is San Diego's foremost nude beach. So there's that for those
there's
interested
in that. There's a lot to look at.
Exactly.
Yeah, the Salk Institute is a Louis Kahn piece of architecture. If you're a fan of Louis Kahn, if you're an architecture fan, you know his name. Joanne, there's a lot of vacation to pack in, but we hope we gave you some great ideas. So thank you for calling. Joe and Joan, we're going to get to you, but we have to sneak in a very quick break. We'll be back in 30 seconds right here on the Fromer Travel Show.
Pauline Fromer, Jason Cochran, The Fromer Travel Show, only here where New York comes to talk, 77 WABC.
No Pauline Fromer today. She is taking a well-deserved day off, but I'm Jason Cochran here with Chris Reynolds from the LA Times, and we are still answering your questions. We have a few minutes left. The number is 800-848-9222, which is the number that Joe from Woodbury, New York called. Hey, Joe, you're live on the air. How can we help you?
Well, for the last few years, we've rented an apartment in East La Verde, and I really don't like hotels. And this was a private apartment, and it was on the 18th floor with a sea view and what have you. But this year, it's already taken up. We waited too long. Mm-hmm. Now, I hear a lot about Airbnb and Vibro, I believe. And
VRBO, yeah.
And when you go on these sites, they sort of want quite a bit of money up front.
Sure.
And I want to know how reliable they are.
Okay, well, there's a difference between VRBO and Airbnb. VRBO is by owner. Vacation rental by owner is what it stands for. So that's a transaction usually between you and them. Airbnb, though, Chris, how is that different and is it safe?
Well, there's a company acting as an intermediary that that demands certain standards from the people who put their houses into Airbnb, and I've used it a few times, and I'm someone who's stayed in a lot of hotels and is sort of accustomed to that drill, and you have to get past the idea that there's no one at the front desk, right? Mm-hmm. But once you get past the idea of that, then all the things that you like about staying in a home or a condo rather than a hotel come to the fore. You usually pay a little bit less. You have a little bit more room. You can feel a little bit like you're in a home away from home. And
they're reliable. I mean, you can look through the previous reviews from people who have stayed in the same place. If there are no reviews, maybe skip it and find one where you know you've seen enough people who have stayed there before and liked it. And I think as far as your money goes, it goes through Airbnb on the way to the owner. So Airbnb is not going to take your money and run.
Right.
So I think you and also pay with a credit card so that if anything bad happens, of course, you can dispute it. But I've never, ever, ever once heard about Airbnb taking anyone's money and running.
In fact, I think the first few years of Airbnb, the hotel industry didn't really take them seriously as competition, but that has changed. And in fact, I should mention that Marriott has actually realized that they're going to try and fight fire with fire. And so they've been signing up people who have homes in London, Paris, Rome, and Lisbon. And there's going to be a Marriott sort of answer to Airbnb.
So they're going to make them outfit their homes to the Marriott standard.
Well, what really cracks me up is on the website that Marriott urges the would-be host to make sure that their homes are furnished with unique pieces to reflect personality.
Whatever the heck that means.
Because when I think of a Marriott hotel, I think of personality.
A lot
of
beige. Joe, does that put your mind to rest about Airbnb? We wouldn't worry about it.
Yes, it sure does.
But just make sure you get those reviews. Yeah, sure. And don't forget, there's someone at Airbnb who can help you if you have any trouble while you're at the stay as well. So thank you very much for calling, Joe. Now we're not Joe, but Joan from Queens. Hey, Joan, you are live on the travel show. Can we help you?
Yes. Hi, gentlemen. Thank you for taking my call.
Howdy.
Hi. My family and I are in the planning stages of a trip. And one of the places we were considering was San Francisco.
Mm-hmm.
And in doing research about San Francisco, it seems that there's an exploding homeless problem, and there are certain streets that can't be, you know, you can't go down those streets, and companies are canceling conventions because of the horrid state of the streets and the homeless problem. And I'm wondering, is that somewhat true, or is it an exaggeration?
Yeah, you know, there's some truth to it. We can't sugarcoat it. You know, a lot of the people who come to California as homeless people come because they know they're not going to freeze to death over the winter. So as social services fall apart in other states, California gets more people coming there just to keep themselves safe. Now, Chris, in your opinion, as someone who covers California to every single day in the Los Angeles Times, what's the situation in San Francisco and how does it impact a trip there?
It is a factor to think about, and certainly in the last 5 years, homelessness has become more pronounced as the cost of owning or renting a place in the city has gone up. So if you want to see less of it, stay off Market Street. Market Street for many years has been a place where you have kind of seen a lot of blight in San Francisco. They've been really working hard to improve it, and there are a number of new like high-tech businesses along that corridor. But still, if you're off Market Street, that will help. And if you're not in the Tenderloin neighborhood, that's sort of ground zero for desperation in a lot of ways.
You mentioned North Beach earlier during the program. That's a pretty good neighborhood to stay in.
Absolutely.
And Fisherman's Wharf is more touristy, but it's also considered a good neighborhood to stay in.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so I mean that you will have some of it, but it is avoidable. And if you just have your street smarts the way you would in New York City, I think you can handle it. But you know, remember New York City like in the 80s and the 70s, you wouldn't go to the Lower East Side too much. You know, you just didn't feel very comfortable. That's sort of like that, but mostly in the Tenderloin and around the Civic Center. But in a lot of other parts of town, they're coming up so quickly. You know, when Twitter moves in and you know, Salesforce moves in, you know, they tend to squeeze out a lot of this stuff. And so that's slowly happening, but maybe not quick enough.
Yeah. And their convention schedule is still pretty darn full. So if you're anywhere near the Moscone Convention Center, you're still going to see lots of people.
Yeah. Yeah. So, yes, it is a concern, but, you know, no more than I think it has been in lots of other American cities in the past. And hopefully we'll be able to get past it as a society. And on that strange, sad note, optimistic, I hope, we have come to the end of another hour. I want to thank my co-host, Chris Reynolds from the Los Angeles Times.
Thank you, Jason.
Go online and read his stuff. It's really terrific. That's why he's Travel Journalist of the Year. I'm Jason Cochran. You can follow us at Fromers, both on Twitter and on Facebook. Thanks so much for joining us, and we'll see you again next week here on the Fromer Travel Show.